This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The Federal Reserve says the economy's all right, not great, but all right. Our national economic poll says, yeah, maybe not so right after all, thanks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is what my calendar says, the 18th of March. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Yellen, comma, Janet, global economy, comma, dangers therein. That, comma, is where we're going to start our weekly wrap. 4 minutes of live radio about the 5 days gone by. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. David Gura is at Bloomberg. They are both in our New York studios at the moment. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Lee, talk to me here for a minute. Janet Yellen and the Fed have a meeting. They say the economy's okay. We're a little worried about the global situation. We're going to raise rates maybe only 2 times this year instead of 4. What's your takeaway?
Well, I mean, it's not that much of a difference, truth be told. I mean, I think by 2018, we still get to basically the same place. She was very clear that she thinks the economy is okay. Nothing to see here. But look, it stoked the markets, as it always does. So,
but that's not what the Fed is for, right?
Of course not. Yeah. No, it's not. Yeah. It's not. But it did.
But it did, which is kind of the way the Fed goes. So, girl, let me ask you this, though. Janet Yellen has been saying for, as long as she's had the job, I and this organization are going to be data dependent. And what she told us yesterday was that the data is pretty good. So why are they not raising rates more this year?
I think that they're proceeding cautiously. I think she used the word prudent or prudently. she was, as you said, happy enough with the state of the U.S. economy, looking at the labor market, looking at housing, inflation, kind of a net zero there.
Yep.
Some signs that it's all right if you have energy in there, a little less great if you have energy in there.
Right.
I think that she's looking at all of the tumult we've seen in the global markets, looking at what other central banks have been doing as well, seeing this divergence in policy, called, seeing these other banks easing while the Fed is not doing that or slowing doing that, and recognizing here that there's going to be no harm done as she sees it to take things a bit slower.
Lee, I am interested, and maybe it's just me, I don't know. It just seems that the Fed and Dr. Yellen are paying more attention to the global situation, at least explicitly, than maybe they have in the past.
They are. I think that's a shift. But I mean, they're right to do so. I mean, the global situation is really uneasy, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon. And, you know, you're seeing, especially with the strong dollar, you're seeing a lot of U.S. multinationals really suffer overseas. And that's a large part of the earnings that drive the stock market. So the global situation is not great.
David, very quickly. Yeah, no, totally. David, very quickly on oil, since you mentioned energy and all that, it's up like 40-something% from its lows of not too long ago. Interesting how that's all going to weigh into the global economy, yeah?
Yeah, we had a bit of a rally this week. I think that slowed down at the end of the week. Getting kind of conflicting signals from the International Energy Agency, I think it was last week, saying maybe we've hit the bottom, see a little light at the end of the tunnel. This week sort of revising that. People still trying to figure out where to lay blame, and there's a lot of uncertainty still in the picture. Yeah. What Iran is going to be able to do, how much oil Iran's going to be able to put into the market, obviously looking at the U.S. Shale sector as well. So still a lot of uncertainty there. Somebody told me, when we bottom out, it's not going to be an instant thing. It's going to be a process. And so we may be at that point, but there's going to be some up and down still.
All right. Lee, moving on to next week, Apple and the FBI have their first real meeting in court. We learned today there's going to be some cross-examination of witnesses. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, is on the cover of either the current Time magazine or the one coming out next week with his thoughts on this case. It does not seem like this is getting any more collegial. It's the positions are hardening, it seems.
They're hardening, absolutely. That's the perfect way to put it. And they're digging in. And Tim Cook has, you know, 40 or so tech companies, his competitors, lining up on his side. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the consumer sentiment seems to be on the other side. It's very, very interesting. And both sides are digging in. Tim Cook said, or Apple said in one of their filings, that the founding fathers would be appalled at this. And one interesting point, actually, in the Time story is that we really don't have anybody to blame for all this but ourselves. You know, it's George Orwell used to say that mass surveillance is coming to everyone and it's going to be the government, but he was wrong about one thing. We did it to ourselves. We asked, we fell in love with these devices, and now they have everything about our lives in them, and so we asked for it.
Lee Gallagher,
it's just a different point.
Yeah, totally. Lee Gallagher, but it's a good point, right? I mean, first thing I'm do when I get out of here is I'm going to grab my phone. All right, we got to go. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, David Gura at Bloomberg from our studios in New York City. Have a nice weekend, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks,
you too.
Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Good session on Wall Street this Friday to round out the week. We'll have the details when we always do. There's a new study out about hedge funds that's kind of interesting. It turns out more hedge funds closed their doors in 2015. Liquidate is the word they use with hedge funds. More hedge funds closed their doors in 2015 than in any year since 2009, which, if you cross-plot a timeline of stocks with the recession, kind of makes some sense. And all of those funds went under, by the way, almost 1,000 of them, without anybody really noticing. It's a far cry from 1998, when the collapse of a fund called Long-Term Capital Management set off a financial panic, and the Fed and major banks ponied up billions of dollars for a bailout. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains why hedge funds and the industry just ain't what they used to be.
So first of all, hedge funds are investment funds that are open only to big-time investors. They are really flexible and usually aggressive in how they invest. The whole idea is to beat the market. Instead, this past year, a lot of them have just taken a beating.
It certainly is a desolate landscape. What can only be described as a slaughter.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon is a professor at UC Berkeley.
It's getting increasingly difficult to outperform the market.
Mark Spindell runs a hedge fund called Potomac River Capital. They manage $600 million.
Markets generally now are still just kind of in this funk of growth isn't so great.
Just look at performance in Europe, Japan, even the U.S. And there are thousands more hedge funds than there were in the 90s, so they can't charge the same hefty fees they once could. So it's harder to turn a profit.
The economics of running these funds, of running these firms, is different than it was pre-crisis. The regulatory costs are higher, and the revenue structure is lower.
When mega hedge fund Long-Term Capital went belly up almost 20 years ago, it threatened to take a lot of financial institutions with it because they had lent the hedge fund money.
We're not seeing that now.
Nicholas Tsafos is an audit and accounting partner at Eisner Amper. He says hedge funds aren't reliant on single banks, and banks aren't reliant on single hedge funds.
A lot of that has to do with the financial crisis that we went through and all the capital requirements that all these institutions are required to have.
So maybe some lessons were learned. Maybe. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yeah, maybe. All right, talking about the recession again, not about hedge funds, but about climate change. If you want to cut carbon emissions, a recession is pretty much a foolproof way to do it. We drive less, we produce less, we emit less when the economy is bad. But in a growing economy, the holy grail of making controlling climate change palatable to everybody has been finding a way to keep on growing and creating jobs while at the same time shrinking our carbon footprint. Tough to do. Haven't had a whole lot of luck on that until this week. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
The big word here is decoupling. This is a divorce we want to see. For four decades now, the International Energy Agency has measured the world economy going up and down in tandem with, holding hands with, greenhouse gas emissions. Until now, says the IEA's Laura Kotze in Paris.
It's the first time that we see 3 years in a row flat emissions despite economic growth going up. So it's a major change vis-a-vis what we have seen up to now.
The question is why? The IEA says the two biggest emitting countries, China and the U.S., are using less coal, and the world is powered by more renewable energy. Big trends here. Well, Earth scientist Steve Davis at UC Irvine isn't so sure. He thinks the good emissions news could be a one-time thing, China shifting away from heavy industry, and not long-term.
We just need to be wary of jumping the gun and assuming that it's happening. If you dig in, you see that there are these structural economic shifts going on, and we can't take this early sign of decoupling as a sign of victory.
The debate over whether we've been lucky or good as far as emissions, it goes on. As for the future, well, one way to lock in low emissions is policy, says economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago. That is, making fossil fuels more expensive to reflect pollution costs or making renewables cheaper.
At the end of the day, markets choose the least expensive energy source. And the only way to guarantee that the least expensive energy source are carbon-free sources is through policy.
Otherwise, CO2 and growth could hook up again. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The top line from the latest Marketplace Edison Research poll of how Americans feel about their personal economies goes like this. Despite a million new jobs in the economy since our first poll back in September, despite wages and inflation ticking up, which is a good thing, even with the Fed talking about things being good enough to raise interest rates, Americans are still economically stressed out. That's the big picture. But we all know that the big picture isn't much good helping you pay your mortgage or figuring out where you're going to get that $1,000 you need to cover the fender bender that you had on the way to work this morning. It's all about how we feel about the economy. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer wraps up our week of poll reports with what economic anxiety looks like up close.
In our survey, we asked people questions like, are you afraid you'll lose your job? How much do you fear not having enough money for retirement or not being able to afford college for your children? Then the big picture question.
Are you frequently anxious about your financial situation?
Sometimes anxious, rarely anxious.
Or never anxious about your financial situation.
That's Larry Rosen, president of Edison Research. He says if you look at the most anxious people in our poll, the top 100 in our Marketplace Economic Anxiety Index, they have a lot in common. A majority are 35 to 54-year-olds.
35 to 54 is when people often have children that they're providing for.
Sometimes they're also supporting their parents.
And they have this looming cliff of impending retirement sort of out there.
No wonder they're anxious. Take 53-year-old Ira Barron. He's in our survey. He isn't in the top 100, but he's facing many of the challenges I just talked about. He lives near Annapolis, Maryland, with his wife, Sharon Simon, and two kids. He agrees to sit down and chat about his answers to our poll. So I make the short drive from Washington.
Hi, Ira. Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Nice to meet you. I was just making coffee. You're a little ahead of the crowd.
We head into a cozy family room and sit down in front of a crackling fire. And Ira talks about what it's like to be in the most worried group of our poll respondents, the 35 to 54-year-olds. He says it's as if he's on a plane with his family. Behind him, clear skies. But looking out the window now,
recognizing for the first time that there's a sort of a cloudy ceiling. I can't see the sun right now.
Ira's got a good job. He's a senior IT executive. He doesn't have to worry about his parents or Sharon's, but he does have children to provide for, a 12-year-old son and 15-year-old daughter, who's just starting to think about where she wants to go to college.
I don't know what college is going to be like. I don't know what it's going to cost. So it's cloudy. I can't see through it.
Then there's retirement.
I don't know what retirement looks like because I haven't really thought about it yet. So it's cloudy.
And it's a double layer of clouds because, like many of our 35 to 54-year-olds, Ira is having to plan for college tuition and retirement at the same time. His wife Sharon walks in.
We don't have a breather in between the two. They're smack dab on top of each other.
There's no intermission between those acts.
And Ira wants to be able to pay for at least part of his kids' college tuition. But back to our plane analogy, he has to put his oxygen mask on first, then help his kids. Ira won't use his retirement for tuition, which, for two kids, can be more expensive than buying a house. And speaking of housing, Ira says they weren't hit hard by the housing crisis, but it got his attention.
While it was a foregone conclusion to me before that you buy a decent house in a nice neighborhood and you're going to get out ahead, there's no longer that guarantee. So part of our economic projection IC being at risk in ways that I had not before the recession.
Ira says they were hit hard by the stock market crash, and he's still trying to repair the damage to his retirement account. But here's the thing. He's not paralyzed with worry. As I'm leaving, he and Sharon actually thank me for making them think about all these things.
But it's time now that we need to start having those conversations. And it's heavy.
And I guess we will again later today.
I'm so sorry. That's such a downer.
No.
And Ira says he will eventually see the sun out of the plane window again.
It's that cloud cover we have to get through, right? Once we're out, I think we'll be fine. All of us.
And Ira says it's actually a luxury to be able to plan, to have money to set aside for a future without turbulence. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a whole lot more about our poll and the anxiety index on our website. Also, while you're there, it would be great, seriously, it would be great if you would take a second and do our quiz, figure out where you fall on the anxiety curve. Check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up.
We're scared. We need this school. It's affordable. It's close by. Good transportation. So we're nervous.
In Illinois, the real-life ramifications of a budget deadlock. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 120 points today. 0.6% closed at 17,602. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about 0.4%, 4,795. The S&P 500 increased 8 points, also 0.4%. 2049. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1.8%, the NASDAQ up 1% on the nose, the S&P 500 advanced 1.3%. Bank of America deposited 2.9% the day after announcing a stock buyback. Ditto JP Morgan Chase, 2.9%. Also on news of its stock buyback. The holiday period left an unexpected gift for Tiffany & Company in a nice little light blue box. Better than expected profits last quarter. The luxury jeweler glittered up almost, you try saying that, luxury jeweler glittered up almost 3% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.87%. You're listening to the Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. South by Southwest wraps up in Austin, Texas this weekend. And for all the hassle the locals go through, there is an upside. Last year, the festival injected $317 million into the local Austin economy. A healthy portion of that cash goes to Ironworks Barbecue. It's a family-owned business not far from the Austin Convention Center in downtown in an unassuming 100-year-old red building. This is the restaurant's biggest 10 days of the year, and General Manager Aaron Morris says that makes all the headache brought by out-of-towners worthwhile. Marketplace tech producer Stephanie Hughes tagged along with Morris, and he told her how he gets the job done.
What you're looking at is an old hickory, one of three smokers that we have here. We bring this one in on a trailer just for South by Southwest, and we cook beef ribs exclusively. We do about 900 pounds in three rotations. It's a lot of meat going through here to keep everybody fed.
You want onion and pickle on them?
We have so many vegetarians that come through South by Southwest that I smoke tofu for them now. And we sell a ton of it every year.
Just this week?
Just for South by Southwest, yep.
Is that going to be it for you today? All right, total's going to be $15.27.
When I was younger, I had high aspirations for Austin, and I wanted the world to see how great our city was. And I think we're dealing with some growing pains, without a doubt, to how, you know, what our city is perceived and marketed. I think we've got to really be careful that we manage that perception and manage this great festival that we have. You know, the one thing you'll hear everybody say is that what, you know, it started off as this little indie thing, a way for Austin to kind of showcase our music scene and whatnot, and it has just grown into a monster. You know, I think probably the number one thing you notice now is the, I mean, insane amount of corporations and different companies that are all fighting for attention over here, and they're really aggressive in how they do that. You know, I saw a pedicab yesterday that was outfitted like a bed, taking people around in a bed on a bike. which I thought was strange. But yeah, it's I guess everybody's trying to one-up themselves for attention. So it's really pronounced now.
That was Aaron Morris. He's the general manager of Ironworks Barbecue down in Austin, Texas. Our Marketplace tech team was out South by all week. Tough duty, yes, I know. And while they were there, they asked all the people they met, and they met a bunch of them, where they go to get their good ideas. Here, first off, is Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox.
You know, I like to take long walks, and when I do that, usually I have time to let thoughts settle in, and sometimes a good idea pops out.
I tend to go back to spreadsheets. I like to just go and pull numbers from various places and just, you know, and I kind of think of data as my dirt that I just like to, you know, get my fingers into and play around with until I can see something new out of it.
As I am waking up from a nap on an airplane, I don't know why, but that is where I get it. So whenever I'm running dry, I'm like, I need to go fly somewhere.
Seems like a hard way to do it. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox first, followed by economist Tara Sinclair from Indeed. And finally, Yuri Minkoff. He's the CEO of the fashion company Rebecca Minkoff. We talked to a bunch more people about their creative processes. Got some great answers, too. You can check them out on our Medium page. We are at Marketplace there. The state of Illinois is going on 9 months without a budget. Republicans and Democrats in the legislature and the Republican governor are putting on a masterclass in political gridlock and what happens when public money doesn't flow. Education is the line item today. Public universities and community college haven't gotten a dime in state funding since last July the 1st. And the state's public colleges, once a model for access and diversity, are now on the brink of collapse. From Chicago, Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
The budget impasse in Illinois has left 9 public universities and dozens of community colleges relying on cash reserves. Now Chicago State University, one of the smaller of the 9, says it's almost out of money. It has shortened its school year, and in a press conference, the university's president, Thomas Calhoun, said he's planning layoffs.
All employees have received notice or will receive notice, including the president of the university, all senior administrators. There are no exceptions.
If the university downsizes or closes, it will disproportionately affect minority students. Nearly 70% of Chicago State's student body is African American. Students like Sarah Mack.
We're scared. We need this school. It's affordable. It's close by. Good transportation. So we're nervous.
The danger of Chicago State closing is a real one because just the potential of it could trigger a downward spiral. Take freshman Noah Burke's plans.
I'm definitely planning on transferring. I'm in the process of it, gathering my transcripts and such. My friends are basically saying they'll go to Atlanta, different cities.
So are they already applying for transfer?
Most of them are.
If enough students take similar preemptive measures, it could jeopardize Chicago State's efforts to survive. If it were to close, the loss would be not just a school, but a unique educational environment, says Cliff Conrad. He's a professor of higher education at the University of Wisconsin and a nationally recognized expert on minority-serving schools.
Predominantly black institutions like Chicago State have cultures and practices that are often very different from mainstream higher education.
Conrad says those practices help better serve traditionally underrepresented students. Meanwhile, the timing of the budget crisis is problematic for all of Illinois' public universities and community colleges. Barbara Gelman-Danley is the president of the Higher Learning Commission, which accredits universities in the Midwest.
It is a very bad time to come up when decisions are being made about fall enrollment. Students may choose not to attend based on the precarious situation of the institutions.
Gelman-Danley's agency has sent notices to all 57 public universities and community colleges in Illinois asking for their financial status. The question is whether there are others among the group, especially those with smaller financial cushions, that are also close to the brink.
We are concerned about a longer-term impact because if an institution becomes increasingly behind in paying its bills, a lot of things can happen.
It's hard to know what all of those things might be because while other states have reduced funding for higher education, none have stopped funding altogether. On top of that, Illinois has also stopped sending money to students in universities and colleges, students who qualify for need-based grants.
It definitely hits low and moderate income students very hard.
Michelle Asha Cooper is president of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Higher Education Policy.
Many of those students also tend to be first-generation students. Many often are students of color.
Cooper says losing state financial aid could mean some of those students give up on college altogether. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, of interest, I would imagine mostly to the slice of you that uses Twitter on a regular basis. Of interest, I would imagine partially at least, to those of you curious about what tech companies have to do to grow and keep making money. Twitter co-founder and CEO Jack Dorsey told the Today Show today that the 140-character limit, arguably Twitter's defining characteristic, isn't going anywhere. There had been some talk that the company was going to get rid of it. Users, well, we pushed back. I don't know if rebelled is really what happened, but we weren't happy. So, you know, chalk one up for users after all. Hey, look at that. It's Friday, quitting time. Gotta go. The Dow up 120 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 increased 8 points, also 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Patty Hirsch is the interim senior producer for another couple of weeks. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.